thesis of the book that Jonathan Haidt says is parents, especially parents in the millennial generation, overprotected children in the real world and underprotected them in the online world. When a woman becomes depressed, it increases the odds of that woman's close friends becoming depressed by 142%. For men, it had immeasurably no effect on his friends. Like, what the hell's wrong with us dudes? Welcome back to another Tutor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
Today we're discussing the book, The Anxious Generation, by Jonathan Haidt. This is a nonfiction book. We're getting out of our realm of fantasy and sci-fi. This book title has a subtitle called How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. So, a lot of heavy stuff in this nonfiction book about social media, internet usage, and how it affects childhood specifically. So, Rich and I, we are the great rewiring generation. We're both
Gen Z,
yeah.
Technically.
We're technically Gen Z. I was born in 1998.
Same for me.
You were born in 1998. So we also wanted to have the perspective here when talking about this book from an older millennial, a really old guy. Chris, Bearded Book Beast, read this book along with us. Chris, welcome to the channel. And we came on your channel, a couple months ago? So yeah, now you're on ours and we're here to chat about the Anxious Generation.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's gonna be fun. I don't know. I like how this is starting. Being the old guy. Jeez.
I mean, you're real close to Gen X.
Yeah.
Some would even say the greatest generation.
There you go. I like that.
And you do have kids as well, Chris, right?
Yes. Yep. I have four kids: 7, 11, 15, and 19. So
whole spread.
I know. We didn't even plan that. Just worked out that way.
This is going to be interesting to hear your takes on this piece, reading from a parent versus two basically children here.
Oh, yeah.
So excited to talk about that. But yeah, we're not really going to do a spoiler warning for this episode very much because it's just the thesis of the book is this. The thesis of the book that Jonathan Haidt says is parents, especially parents in the millennial generation, overprotected children in the real world and underprotected them in the online world. Mm-hmm. And this entire book explores why that has caused an increase in anxiety and depression. Would you guys recommend the book? I'll start with Chris with you of, if you want to say, would you recommend it? Would you get out of it? General things before we start getting deep into it.
Yeah, I would recommend it. I think it is a very good read and he brings up a lot of good points. He hits the nail on the head with a lot of things, and we'll talk about some other things. I think he brushes a pretty broad stroke over some other things that I don't necessarily agree with. He draws a straight line sometimes where I think there's a lot more to it, and we can talk about that later on. But I think it's a great book. I think he makes some really good points, and I think it's very eye opening to a parent who's raising kids and in the technology age. And I think that it's a very important thing that we all see and think about. And I think we can all get something out of it.
What about you, Rich?
Yeah. When reading this book, I went to the perspective that I thought I knew what it was going to say.
Yeah.
And ultimately it didn't say anything that I didn't kind of already intuitively know when I was, you know, growing up like this. And, you know, I was once a youth. So I kind of understood all this, but it was really great to hear it actually articulated in a coherent way, especially with figures, graphs, explanations, great anecdotal evidence that really visualizes the problem. So I really like this book. So I wouldn't know how to recommend it to a parent because I'm not a parent myself, but I'll take Chris's word on it.
What would you put your Rambler rating sticker on it? What would it be?
I actually did give it a rating at a 3.75.
Really good.
Really good book.
Neat. Yeah, I agree. A lot of this stuff, especially maybe because it's perspective of we were born in 1998, grew up with social media. And so as the book is explaining what happened, he very accurately explains our childhood of how social media was introduced, and we see the effects in our peers and in ourselves more so than that too. So everything that Jonathan Haidt was saying to you and I is more intuitive, I'm sure, to even you, Chris, but very much these are things we understood. I would say toward the end, he comes up with some solutions. I think if you were to read this book as a parent, not me being a parent, but my recommendation would be this book can apply to how you parent, but he has some things that he stretches to, like, governments do this and society do this, which it's hard to just make that change unilaterally. Yeah. He does make a good point, like, hey, look, we were able to curve smoking and put seatbelts. So we'll get into deep stuff about it, but I give it 4 stars. Great book. I recommend it for, just as you said, Rich, it puts what you kind of intuitively know into numbers, and you can then refer to this, and it has logical ways of explaining why specifically, like, we can intuitively go, social media is bad for your brain.
I don't think anybody alive today looks and goes like, yeah, social media, great. Great for everyone. Great for your mental well-being. Like, how many times do people say, like, oh, yeah, I need to go on a social media detox, or I just need to get out of the internet. Like, that's common for us. That's almost everyone believes this, but this is a great way of, like, exactly why, kind of shoving it in your face of, like, no, this is not just a problem in the ether. This is a real problem that can have real solutions if you actually do something about it. It's not something to just take on the chin. We as a people can actually turn this course around.
Chris, did you see the same too? Was a lot of this intuitive for you, where you read it and went, hey, even as a parent, and you have four kids, all age ranges, did you know this inherently?
Yeah. Like Richard said, it was stuff that I knew, but just like he said, to hear it explained so well, and he has all the numbers and everything to back it up. He does great analogies so that you can kind of really think about really what it is like, especially his early one that we'll talk about. But also, I'm a teacher too. And for the past few years, I've taught high school, and cell phone usage, we'll talk about that. Like, a lot of what he said too, just for that, like, as a teacher, it struck home with, and some of the students that I've worked with and some of the issues they've had, because I've worked in special ed resource. So, like, I don't work with, I work with students who are in general ed classes, but they have depression, anxiety, social things and stuff like that, that I help them with. So even with that, it spoke to me a lot. So, I knew a lot of the stuff, but it was very interesting to hear him talk about it. And then, like you said, some of his solutions, I think, are great ideas, but like you said, it's kind of hard to, when it's out of your hands, but he gives some good ideas that people can do on their own too. So it was really good, I think.
Well, we have the perfect guest for a teacher, parents,
working with, you know, and special needs kids with depression, all these. Like, yes, this is the perfect guest.
We did great inviting Chris.
Oh yeah.
Go us.
Kudos to us.
Well done. Well done.
But Chris, you have 4 children before even reading this book.
Yeah.
When you were raising your first kid, was the idea of limiting social media or limiting just internet access in general, was that on your mind, or was it not much of a concern with at least the first child?
It definitely got more as each kid, as time went on and as technology grew and the use of technology grew. I think for my early one, it was more just like, what is this Snapchat, you know, what is this Instagram, you know, is it safe for them to be on it? And then I could control that. But then as time went on, and all the way down to my youngest now, it's like, man, nothing is safe. I mean, and there's just no, we'll talk about it, but he hits in the head so many times, because all a kid has to do, there's a law that says they have to be 13. But all they got to do is put in my email address, and it says, are you 13? Yes. Does your parent know you're doing this? Yes. There you go. Have fun. You know, so it's just,
but children don't lie. Thinking, it's fun.
Yeah. And like these my youngest two love to play like Roblox. I mean, a lot of people do, adults do too. Mm-hmm. So they can be on there and they can be talking to people, and I can set up all the parental controls, do all this stuff, but there's so many workarounds nowadays. Kids talk, it's just crazy, man. As time has gone on. So the first child, I was like, all right, I'm going to control how much you're on your screen. Make sure you go outside, all those kinds of things. Make sure you do what you're supposed to do. But it was really easier to control. It was just like, don't let them get on TikTok. Don't let them get on this, that, you know. Mm-hmm. But now it's even if you keep them on safe things, even YouTube Kids, there's things that'll pop up on there somehow that are inappropriate. Like it's a much scarier place now than when my 19-year-old was young, for sure.
Yeah, I believe that the author, Jonathan Haidt, he wrote this in 2023, 2 years mm-hmm. ago now, and he has kids of his own, 15 and 18, I want to say. And just to give his quick background, he is he's a professor at NYU, and he has a PhD in social psychology from the University of Pennsylvania and taught at the University of Virginia. He also published the books The Coddling of the American Mind and The Righteous Mind as well. So he, while doing research for this book, The Coddling Mind, he found this intuitive link about social media and its connection to, and him being a parent, probably seeing this in his kids as well, which I'm sure you've seen as well, Chris. So that, I guess let's start diving into the book now. Let's get in. So if people want to go read the book, check it out. It'll be linked in the description. But the thesis of it is, again, overprotecting in real world, underprotecting online. Do you agree with that thesis? Did you as a parent that way as well? Or you and your wife as parents, did you parent that way?
Yeah. I mean, not that like exactly like that, but yeah. I mean, you know, I made mistakes for sure. And I think that this is some overprotecting outside of the internet, I think, is some of the area where I think he paints things a little broad to fit his narrative a little bit at times, because he'll say things like that. Like he mentions that is much more unsafe than it is now. And nobody, but like, there were things happening then too, and there were predators and there was things that you had to worry about, but you just didn't hear about as much because there wasn't internet and social media and all that kind of stuff. So like, sometimes I didn't like how he said that kind of stuff, because nowadays, like, I don't know, he's talking about how back then it wasn't uncommon to see a 7 or 8 year old going off on their own in a neighborhood or, you know, far away from their house. And yeah, when I was that age, I probably rode bikes with my friends and was far away from the house. But like, I don't know, as a parent now, I look at that and I think, that's kind of dumb. You know, I don't know. Like I would not let, and I don't, maybe I'm overprotective, but I let my 7-year-old go outside in my yard and play, or at the neighbor's house and play. And I'm not like on her like glue, but I wouldn't let her go walk 4 blocks away by herself or something like that. I don't know. So, I definitely probably did that. And then early on, I probably underprotected online, like I said, because I just thought, all right, if I have these parental controls in place and if I don't let them get certain apps, they're going to be safe. And I found out, you know, the hard way that there's nowhere really safe online for kids if you let them go for too long, or if you feel too safe, bad things can happen. So
watch how kids do to rambles on the internet.
Yes, right.
If you start getting into BookTube, I do like to think that's why we're combating the social media stuff. We are on social media, so we are hypocrites in a way, but mm-hmm. being books yeah. makes it a little better. Right?
Yeah.
I think so.
I choose to live in the reality with that makes my own existence slightly more positive.
Exactly.
Whether it's true or not, I choose that reality.
That's right. I like it.
Did you have that experience, Rich, for you growing up? Did you feel that you were overprotected real world, underprotected online?
Not in particular. So at least for my childhood, I lived in a relatively nice enough suburb for most of my life. And so I had friends in the neighborhood, so I would ride my bike around. I'd go to the store when I was much younger. I remember just making a call and, you know, like, hey, let's hang out, Zach, and then, you know, ride my bike about 30, 40 minutes trying to get there.
Oh, you know, 30, so, 40 minutes? How old are you when you did that?
I don't know. Young. I think, like, before middle school. I don't know. I would hang out in... Now, this is... My mom watches all of our videos, so... Hi, mom. little tiny Richard experiments out in the wilderness was hanging out in the arroyos. So arroyos in New Mexico are these, because we have because the land is so dry, there's a lot of flash flood problems. So we have to have these ditches that basically take all the rainwater and keep it away, so it's not actually flooding everything. Mm-hmm. Anyway. My friends and I would hang out in the arroyos all the time, which you're very much not supposed to do, because if it floods, you get swept away.
And your mom knew of course.
No, of course not. Oh. She probably knew. But no, we'd hang out there. We'd go exploring out in the wilderness. There was, you know, there's a hole in the fence that gets you out into, like, this government area that was owned by the government, but no longer.
Man.
Like, there was a...
How old were you?
Yeah. Like,
10 something,
10 11 maybe,
so two
something like that,
something to key in. So if you were 10 11, that would have been 2010 2011, around that range. So Jonathan Haidt, the great rewiring he talks about, he says it happens from 2010 to 2015. That's a statement of that's when you see smartphone, iPhone, front-facing camera, essentially the online world, social media, likes, and all of that occurs. So I think you and I, since we're 98, we were middle school going into high school. We were on that cusp of, just as we're getting into high school, social media is actually becoming a thing, and phones are becoming, smartphones are becoming mass market. So
my mom has always been really against social media, internet usage, really heavily against it. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't let me get a phone until basically me and my friend got lost at a state fair, and she was like left looking for me for like hours, and got worried mainly for her, for my friend, like going, uh-oh, I can't like lose another person's child. That's unacceptable. And so got me a, you know, a flip phone.
Yep.
But I didn't get a smartphone until well into high school. I think senior year of high school, I got a smartphone.
So you were probably 17.
Something like that.
Yeah. So you weren't the exact person they're talking about in this book, but it probably hit you later. So maybe 17 to 20 to today.
See, I got a laptop, and that sometime in high school, and that I stopped reading because I got a laptop and YouTube and video games. And so
YouTube. Which, if we haven't mentioned, Chris, Bearded Book Beast is your channel. So please, go subscribe to Bearded Book Beast. He has another BookTube channel. Where we also chatted with you. What did you have us on, just a ramble and whatnot, or did we talk?
It was just on I do interviews or just live chats with BookTubers and authors called Beast Friends Forever. Play on the word best friends forever.
Well, Chris, I wanted to go a little deeper into your point on that. You said Jonathan Haidt maybe paints with too broad a brush over the overprotection of kids in the real world and underprotection. So kind of agree on the underprotection of kids online, but you would disagree on in the real world.
I do agree with that point. Like, and like he said, in generics, that I do think that when you compare it to how people are with kids online, I mean, there's so many parents of kids that I worked with and friends of my kids that, they can do whatever they want online. The tablet's just like their babysitter. They get it. They have no parental controls on it. But then, like, in the real world, they're like, you know, where are you going? What are you doing? You can't do this. You can't do that. And it's like, so I agree with, but there's just little things that he says. Like, there's a point where he says people overprotect in the real world now, where used to they let them do whatever. And it's, he says like that it's much safer now. He alludes to it being much safer in the world now, in the real world, for a kid. I agree to a point, but like, I just feel like, I don't know. Nobody lets their kid get hurt or abducted on purpose. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm trying to recall from the book, was he saying more so that the real world is safer than the online world, or was he saying that it's safer today?
I think he just meant like people are so overprotective today, and they weren't back then. But nowadays he thinks with the structures and things in place, it's probably actually safer than it was back then. And that I don't know. I feel like you always got to be a little bit vigilant with your kids. But I get what he's saying. He's making that comparison that we're so protective nowadays when we didn't used to be. And it's not like it's any more unsafe than it was back then, I think is what he's really trying to say. And maybe it was just how I took it. But he's really making that comparison to people just aren't protective at all of their kids online, but they're super overprotective in person in the real world. So I do agree with that.
Because I believe he's making the general point of generally ever since, like, there was a rise in crime in the 1990s, but through our at least United States nation's history, crime and crime toward children has gone down. But now,
overprotective?
But yeah, that's a question. But so crime has gone down against children, but the awareness of individual crime has gone up with the internet, with 24-hour news cycle, all these things every incident nationwide is heard. And so it makes it feel like, oh, there's actually more crime. It's more dangerous now than
true.
The actual reality of things.
He refers to Frank Furedi, who wrote that book called Paranoid Parenting, Why Ignoring the Experts May Be Best for Your Child. And that's where he talks about the 24/7 news cycle and the big scandals that would come out about the Catholic Church, about the Boy Scouts. And what he calls the breakdown of adult solidarity, essentially. How can you trust your fellow adult if your fellow adult is also the enemy? So it's less community. It's less, how can you trust your neighbor? You're talking about, hey, your kid goes to your neighbor. I'm sure you trust them. You know that neighbor. But now that you see all these stories of, look at this neighbor that you kind of think you know, but the neighbor ended up being a murderer.
I know. It's wild, man. It's scary. And someday you guys are going to find it out when you have a kid too. It's a scary world out there, and it is hard. And that's why I loved this book too, because, you know, there is some truth to that. If you're too overprotective, your kids do need to learn how to stand on their own two feet. They need to be able to fail. They need to be able to experience things and work through them and figure it out. Because if you overprotect them too much, they're going to be an adult that doesn't know what to do in situations and needs their parents all the time. And that's not really great for them to start off life that way. So it was a really good wake up call for me in that way too.
I really appreciate his examples that he was bringing up, especially with his daughter, I believe, where it was always about finding the line of, like, not something that she can, like, giving her a test that she can already do, but always trying to reach for, and also not something that she's not ready for, but finding that just fine line of you're not ready for it yet, and so let's have you try it. And so just always pushing that boundary, and that's how you grow. It's learn by doing something you can't quite do yet, but not too hard.
Right.
Anyway, I loved those little things, and just,
I did too.
There's also the allure of, especially like your parents, maybe my parents as well. The ability to track your kids was a lot harder.
Oh, yeah.
Like, ultimately, my mom just had to kind of trust me when I go out and say, like, hey, I'm going to Zach's house.
Yeah.
She's just going to have to trust
it.
She'll say, hey, call me in 30 minutes. Call me every couple hours or whatever the rule was. Mm-hmm. But now you put an air tag in their shoe and you know exactly where they are. And
no, you set a drone and you start
follow them.
You got to get real. Yeah, that's definitely different, where you can you can overprotect them with the actual technology too.
It's now easier to do it. And you ask yourself as a parent of going, if I can, like there is an easy available tool to protect my children. Why the hell wouldn't I?
Why would I not do it?
Why would I not try and protect my children? It's right there.
It is. Yeah.
Speaking as a parent, do you have a couple of those moments of going like, maybe this would be safer, but I think I need to let my kid go. Have you had a couple of those moments?
I have. And like, I think, I guess like, I feel like once my kids have like my older two, once I have my 9-year-old, she's out of school now. And then my 15-year-old, he's going to be a sophomore. And I feel like once they hit that like late middle school, early high school age for both of them, I kind of got to a point where it was like that, where it was like, okay, I can keep monitoring things. I can keep trying to be in control of this, or I could start to trust them a little bit. I feel like I know the type of little person they are now, you know, and let's see how it goes. And so far it's paid off well. And, I feel like I have a good relationship with both of them. They're pretty open and honest with me. And, you know, and I'm sure you guys as parents did this with you too, when you're that age, it's like, they know that if they do mess up and they go somewhere they shouldn't, they get into trouble, I want them to call me. I'm not going to, you know, if they're in trouble and they need me, even if I'm going to be upset, first is going to come them getting home safe. So they know they can always call me. But yeah, I definitely had some of that, because it is, like you said, you can do it so easily now with apps and, you know, Life 360 and all that stuff. And I did have to be like, okay, I'll keep monitoring the little ones, but I need to give them some space, and I need to trust them, because, yeah, like you said, they got to learn.
Do you remember a specific moment where you were going to use something to try and monitor your kids, and then you pulled back? It's like, no, I'm going to resist the urge to overprotect them.
Yeah, yeah. I don't let my kids get cell phones till, well, my oldest, I didn't let her get it until she had her license and she was driving. And then I was going to be that way with all of my kids. But then my son, I let him get one because me and my wife would both be working most days and he'd get home from school earlier and he'd be by himself for a couple hours. And it was like, he's like 14. Like, I could probably let him get a phone so that he can reach out to me if he needs to, you know? So with him having a phone and my younger two having tablets, I ended up getting like a Life 360 type app, and you can see like, you know, what they're doing, how long they've been on the screen, their apps they go on, all that stuff. And I was gonna, sync it up to my daughter's phone, and she was like 17 at the time, 17, 18. And then, I mean, I connected her phone, but I didn't turn on like everything. So I did have this moment where I thought about it, cause I had friends that did, and like they had like a senior, and it was like every text message they sent or anything they sent, they could see. And it was just like, I just feel like that's a little too much to me. I don't know. I mean, it's good. And maybe their kid needed it. Maybe they needed to see what he was saying, but like, that was a time where I felt like, okay, she's getting ready to be a senior. She's going to graduate. She's going to be on her own. Like, I need to trust her and not be looking at all her messages. Like, that's just crossing a line, you know? So I didn't. And, she's doing awesome. You know, she's a great young lady, and, I'm really proud of her. So, and we have a great relationship. So I feel like that was the right choice. Nothing bad happened. And, I feel like if I had done it, I feel like it would have broken some of the trust that I had built with her through the years. So I don't know. It's every kid's different. Every parent's different. Every situation is different. But yeah, that was definitely a time when I made that choice. And I think it was the right one.
So of your kids, how many now have a smartphone and social media access?
Just my oldest. Well, and she's 19. She lives on her own. So she's got, I can't really do anything about that anymore. So she does. Although she, I am still paying her cell phone bill, which that's maybe a different conversation, you know, but it makes it so hard not to keep doing that though, when you have the bundle, you know, the family plan or whatever.
Oh, I stretched that. Actually, I think that's the one thing my parent, wait, do I? Yeah, I'm on my mom's bundle still and I'm 27.
Same.
I think that's the last vestige I have for my parents is the phone bill.
No. I was going through a bunch of things like when I finally became fully financially independent, mm-hmm. I could get off different insurances whenever those tiers come around. And that was the last one going like, hey, I can get off the cell phone plan. And my parents were kind of looking at going, yeah, don't bother. It's gonna cost us more to get you a bundle.
Off. Yeah.
It's a bundle deal. Like the difference between paying, you know, $10, $15 a month and $65. Just buy me lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
Every so often. Like just do that. Yeah. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. I agree.
Do you both agree then? So his suggestion, Jonathan Hyatt's, am I saying his name right too?
I think it's Hyatt.
Jonathan Hyatt's, his suggestions for kids is, he has four. No mm-hmm. smartphones before high school. He says no social media before 16. Phone-free schools and more unsupervised play and childhood independence. So broader suggestions at the end there.
Yeah.
And it seems that you did, Chris, for your oldest daughter, you did wait to give her access till she had her driver's license, so 16. But for your son, you did 14. So you were almost there. But it seems like you naturally almost fit with a couple of his suggestions here over time where you didn't give them a phone when they were 8, 9 years old.
Right. No, yeah. I think it's just too... And I don't know. Sometimes I regret letting my younger ones have tablets because nowadays there's apps they can download. Like there's an app called WhatsApp, which I am not a fan of, which basically makes their phone gives them like text messaging. So then they can share like this WhatsApp number with other kids. And then who knows who they could be talking to. So that's one that I had to like lock down, you know?
Yeah.
And that's another one that a kid can just start. And it's like, ooh, gosh, like really? Just say I'm 13, even though you're 10 and there's nothing, you know, to back it up. Like you'd think I would get an email just to approve it or something, but then a kid could just create an email and say, oh, this is my parents' email. You know, it's wild. It's wild how easy it is to get stuff. But yeah, he has a phone. So I guess he had access to the internet, but he wasn't allowed to get, like any social media accounts till he got this year. I did let him get like an Instagram account because kids talk a lot more through apps than they do text messages. I found that Snapchat's a big one that they use for messaging, which I don't. I mean, we all, you know why I don't like Snapchat.
Disappears, no one knows.
The whole point is the more anonymous disappeared message.
Yes, point of it. Mm-hmm. Yep, I know. And but that's
he says that he knows it's hard for parents because if you don't have social media at a certain age, you become more of an outcast or loner of who. Mm-hmm. It's such conformity that if everybody has it, it's almost you are socially ostracized because you're missing a big connection that kids do have. Because as soon as they leave school, other people can contact their friends and catch up. And if you're the kid without the phone, it's almost you're compelled to have it because the group has it. And
are you socially isolating your kid by keeping them off
these apps?
And that's
a burden on the parents because you're going, well, man, everybody, how is he going to talk to his friends? How's she going to talk to her friends? And then we kind of walking back a little bit, the book gets at the four things, which I think this is interesting because I think we intuitively know this too. But these are the four things that is different about communication in the virtual world on social media versus in person. And he lays these four out saying the first one is that it's disembodied. So obviously we are not seeing each other physically. So in the virtual world, we're not getting cues. We're not getting normal embodiment and seeing how to respond to somebody doing something in the moment. And that's the second thing is it's asynchronous. asynchronous. Yeah, I can't say that word. Asynchronous.
That's a hard one.
It's asynchronous for specifically text and messaging, because if you're sending something and then you're waiting for something to come back, you're not getting live feedback. The third, this is a very important one. The last two are the most important. The third is it's one to many. So if I'm just talking, that's why a lot of the times you see it's easy to hate online. It's easy to be anonymous and say something, because if you're talking one to one, it's more personal. It's engaged to this person, and your empathy is there. Your mammalian nature is also, hey, I'm in this group. This is my neighbor. I should probably be nice to the person I have to live next to. And it's a one-on-one versus one to the ether of wherever they live. I'm not going to see this person ever. Who cares? Anyways, then the last one is obvious too, but the low bar for entry, the low barrier to entry, where if online and saying something, there's such a low barrier to entry to just go and spew something and say something, versus if you're going to say that in front of somebody to their face and then go, hey, I don't like your opinion on blank. I think your opinion on the anxious generations sucks. And it's much easier to comment that than it is to say in person. So all those things very quickly in from 2010 to 2015, as he puts it, that great rewiring of just changing how we communicate instantaneously. Obviously the internet existed, but social media hyper focusing on that, magnifying that issue. Those four differences, it just kind of explaining why. So he goes into why is social media actually bad for us as humans, of what did it change about how we communicate? That portion I thought was neat to kind of just dive into. It makes sense why it's so disconnected. We could feel that when we are talking online, it's connection, but you're really almost isolating yourself more. But did you both get anything from those portions as well?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it was very interesting and well done. And I definitely think it does. It does change, especially probably a little more after your guys's generation. Like you think about kids that were, you know, when you were in middle school that were just being born, that when they've literally grown up and then they get old enough where they can watch a tablet or play games, and parents are so busy, life is so busy, they get a tablet and then they start, their friends have tablets, and then they have a tablet at school, you know, and they slowly just learn how to communicate online like that. And that's just all they know, or with a phone. I mean, there's some kids, some of my youngest, she just finished first grade. And even last year in first grade and the year before that in kindergarten, there were some kids that had phones at her age. And it's just wild to me. And it's like, they're learning their whole life. That's how they communicate. And you see like, well, that's why a lot of them do struggle to communicate in person. You know, with my kids, I always try to, as they get older, make them like order their own food or do things like that. And with every kid, it's gotten harder for them to do it because they're used to communicating in person less and less.
To actually speak in front of someone and to have a in-person communication.
Interesting.
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Wow. Yeah, do you run into these kind of same problems with the kids that you take care of at work as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. This is probably the area more that I thought of when I mentioned that he draws a straight line or a broad stroke, is some of the mental health stuff that he connects to this. And I think it plays a big role, but I don't think it's like the, and I guess he doesn't say it's the only thing. And he's very good about saying like, every kid's different, every situation's different. You know, there's some things that don't fall into this. But I mean, there are a lot of the kids I work with have depression, anxiety, things like that. And it's not, there's so many factors that go into it. It's not like you can just say, well, it's because they had a phone at a young age or had, you know, had social media, you know, because a lot of them deal with, and I see it in the halls myself and I have to stop it. They deal with bullying and getting bullied in the real world, you know, and then their group of safety and friends and people where they feel like they can be themselves is online. So sometimes it's kind of tough. It's like, it's not black and white, but I definitely see it with a lot of my students. They like a school or a phone free school would be cool. And there actually is a couple of schools, not mine, but there's a couple of schools that do the, they walk in and there's people whose job it is. They have these pouches. They put their phone in the pouch, they lock it. And then, the phone doesn't work all day. Like it blocks all the service. And then at the end of the day, they unlock it and they get the phone back. And, it'd be interesting to see at these schools, how like the statistics of how it goes. But in my school, we had these things they tried. They were like, you ever seen like the shoe, organizers you hang over a closet door?
Yeah.
They're like that. And they're called phone hotels. Supposed to make it sound cool, but the kids call them phone jail. You know,
thinking of 13-year-old me going, no, they had to name it something so quirky and stupid.
Oh, yeah. They hated it.
What do they do there? They have to put their phone in the hotel.
Yeah, when they walk in, they're supposed to put their phone in it. Mm. And of course, there's always kids that say, I don't have a phone. And then 2 seconds later, they're on it or it rings in their bag or something. And then it became like, okay, well, you can't make a kid put it in there. So they can put it in there or they can keep it in their backpack. But if they get it out, then it goes in there, stuff like that. But like for me, it was so hard to motivate my students because they had such low motivation and work ethic. And a lot of them just hate school in general because it's so hard because of some of their learning disabilities and social issues and stuff. It got to a point where it's like, okay, I'm supposed to, if they get all their work done, I can let them go on their computer and watch YouTube or whatever. And it's like, if they really want to be on their phone that bad, it got to the point where it was like, okay, if you get all this stuff done, then you can have your phone for the last, you know, 15 minutes. Cause to me, it was like, what's the difference between watching YouTube on the computer or watching YouTube on your phone? If it's going to get you to get your stuff done, you know, but it was just, it's a constant battle with phones all the time. And I can't even imagine it because in my classroom, I would only have, you know, maybe 5 or 6 kids at the most, very small groups I worked with, but in a class of 25, 30 kids, when they're trying to get their phones out, I mean, we had so many times where kids would secretly record teachers and sometimes they would do it. Like if a teacher would get upset with the class about something and go off on them, they're like recording it and then posting it and just so many bad things from phones in school. But it's hard. It's tough because then, and I, as a parent, I never was one that was like this, but parents would say, well, how can I get a hold of them? And then it's like, well, I mean, you can email them, you can call the school. Like if it's an emergency, there's ways to get a hold of them. You don't have to text them and have them respond to you in that moment.
I mean, isn't that how it's kind of always worked? You call the school and then the school gets on the intercom, you know, Billy, come to the office.
Come to the office, yep.
Yeah.
I know. And I think that's where, like he talks about some of the overprotecting, underprotecting comes into play, where they don't see like how that's a problem, that they expect to be able to call or email, text their kid in the middle of class and they should be able to answer right away. It's like, that's not how it works.
To be fair, I have that problem with just in general. I think everyone has an expectation to be able to reach everyone like that. And I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I think text messages should be, there should be a social understanding of treat it like a letter. I can, yeah. I'm allowed to get back to you within two to three business days. That is acceptable. It should be, at least.
It takes a while for the horse and carriage to travel up to the satellite.
Exactly.
To your phone.
It is not me being at that speed. It is not me being rude of not responding to you within, right, you know, 2 minutes. It's rude of you to expect me to drop everything that I'm doing and to respond to you. No, I got stuff going on.
I
got things. And the same, like, kids have things going on at school. You can't just distract them.
Yes, yes. Yep, I agree.
There's, again, he has a lot of fours he likes to do. The four foundational harms of social media use was: one, social deprivation, obviously. Two was sleep deprivation. Three was attention fragmentation, which you were just talking about, if you're constantly needing to distract yourself. And four is addiction. And all four of those are he lays out why each four of those are bad and shows that it's not just correlated, but it's causated as well, which I know you, Chris, brought up some, hey, there's also some other causes too, but do you generally agree with his point that there is a direct causation to the increase in anxiety and depression because of those four foundational harms?
I think it's definitely, those are definitely always part of it. I think, I don't think there's ever a time where if someone has anxiety or depression, that isn't either a root cause of it or something that increases it, for sure. So either way, it's definitely related. But I just think that I think sometimes in society today, I do think that, and I think my generation and older is probably much more guilty of this than maybe your guys's or younger, is just blaming anytime a kid's different or has certain lifestyle choices, that it's they blame it on certain things. And a lot of times it's social media and phones and internet and video games and all this stuff. But that's where I don't think it's, I think, I don't know, that's a whole other conversation. We shouldn't get into,
you don't want to compare, or are you thinking the idea of painting social media with as broad a brush as maybe you remember with like D&D or something, how it was like, D&D, the reason why you're,
right,
you know, weirdos.
Violence in video games.
Yeah, violence in video games. Or
That's a perfect
look at
example.
All these Satanist D&D players.
And I think I see that a lot now.
Or is it something is it something different?
It's I think, like I said, it plays a role, but I think that it can be dangerous. I've seen some kids that just have a lot of struggles because you know, their parents or other adults in their life don't they just say, you're this way because of this, so let's get rid of your phone, let's get rid of the internet, and then you're going to be solved, you're going to be normal. And like that kind of stuff to a kid that's trying to find their way, like, I don't know. I've seen it be very destructive to their psyche. And when all they really just need is someone to just say, you know, I see you how you are, and I respect you and value you as who you are, and give them room to find themselves and grow. But that's a different conversation. But I do see that a little bit. So when he was just trying to make the point that social media and everything plays a huge role in anxiety and depression, and some of the choices that young people make when it's cool, if it's what everybody else is doing, if they heard this person said to do it. But that's not just, it's not always the case. It's not always that straight of a line or black and white is all that I took from it. But I do think he's got very valid points and pointed out that it plays a role for sure.
Yeah. Before 2010, and the stats were the great rewiring, 2012-ish, where they start skyrocketing more. Of course, there was depression and anxiety before 2010. It didn't just start in that year.
Right.
However, the correlation you see is, here's just one stat. I obviously, there's a lot of graphs in this book, so I didn't get every single one. But depression among teens is up from 2004 to 2020, up about 150-ish percent about 140% for boys, 160-ish% for girls. The rate of self-harm from 2010 to 2020 tripled for adolescent girls. And you can go down the line and show all these effects of what actually happened. Then you go to what could be potential causes. And he talks about in the book why he's trying to get that causal link in there. He shows some anecdotal evidence, but the more compelling stuff is where he shows here's how it's caused. You can say maybe this generation has more traumas to deal with and there's more world events going on. And he compares.
Also the idea of, are the numbers higher because the culture around mental health is more positive in coming forward? So people are less repressive of their mental illness and that the numbers themselves don't really show that. That doesn't particularly make sense.
Because it's not just you saying you're depressed. It's looking at hospitals and looking at how many people are being admitted for trying to commit suicide. So you can't fake
that's not just self-reports. You can't repress that before. Like, you either went to the hospital or not. Those things don't really change.
He uses things that are more immovable to prove the causation. So, and it's also something, it helps that intuitively, I also agree as well, of it makes complete sense. I also, personal experience of seeing, there's an anecdote he uses here of taking away a phone from some young girl for a couple of weeks and just her happiness skyrocketing. Just in your own life, if you just feel, obviously there could be a lot of causes, a lot of causations could be in effect, but have you ever gone, you know, you go on a weekend trip to, we're at a lake and less social media and you're with people, you're having fun and you get back and you're going, well, obviously the fun stuff and vacation was also cool, but just try putting your phone away for 2 days and just see, oh, did that make you a little happier? Huh? Maybe a little bit, because comparison's the thief of joy. You hear that a lot, but it also is very telling that. Yeah. In this book, it dives into specifically young girls and young boys and how there's big differences in how both react. And it shows that young girls are much more affected by social media use than young boys. Mm-hmm. A stat that was a little funny, actually. There was a funny stat in here. Depressing but funny stat is when a woman became depressed, a woman, not talking girls anymore, but when a woman becomes depressed, it increases the odds of that woman's close friends becoming depressed by 142%. For men, it had immeasurably no effect on his friends. Like, what the hell's wrong with us, dudes?
What's wrong with us?
That's both sad, but I'm going, wait, should we be proud of that? Like, well,
man.
Oh, wait, we don't care about each other. We're not empaths.
We compartmentalize.
I'm going,
that's
what?
Right. We do compartmentalize.
But it does go to show just more biologically when you think intuitively, there's generally speaking, young girls on social media more internalize emotions and generally speaking young boys externalize young emotions, so it comes out in violence in this or showing out, and so us boys, we might not internalize that depression or anxiety, but we'll then go we'll let it out in violence. So I
absolutely love that, like the kid I got in middle school when I some kid was like fighting me and like didn't like some beat me up and then like we just got into a fight. We were friends like the next day. It took a couple days, but we were friends after that. It's all it took. And yet you
trauma bound.
Yeah, exactly. No, every fight I've been in, I've become relative friends with that person afterward. There are other people that never fought me that I will still hate to this day. That's just
you didn't have the gall to duel me, you bastard.
there is something about the respect of it. Like someone who just badmouths you behind your back and is just catty, I'm never going to respect you and like you. But if you dislike me enough that you want to, you know, throw hands, I got to respect it. I clearly did. Like, it causes you to self-reflect of going, man, they're willing to threaten like bodily harm. What happened? What did I do? What happened to put me in this situation? Because something.
What did I do?
No, seriously.
What's wrong with me?
Like, it's a question. Sometimes it's not valid, but I don't know. You remember going, I was kind of a dick. Yeah, I did poke the bear. Maybe it's not the right reaction to have to, like, you know, a yo mama joke, but fair enough.
And then there is real bullying too. Of just there's no reason for
yes,
it.
Yes, of
and
course.
I'm sure a lot of your students go through that, Chris. Of just disabilities as well, because kids can be dicks.
Oh yeah,
and yes. those kids exist. And so that difference to bring up of social media more so affects young girls generally, but also it increased both for boys and girls. But since the boys started off at a lower percentage, numerically less boys than girls were suffering through anxiety and depression. But for young boys, it shows how porn and video games is large portion of what typically affects younger boys more than it did for younger girls. And he shows that the addiction rate, so of those four things, he was saying social deprivation, sleep deprivation, et cetera, but addiction for things such as porn and video games is roughly 5 to 12% for typical addictions of young boys. Take like 7.5%. Say that's quite a lot. That's quite a lot if you're to take the entire population of not just the United States, because he makes very clear not to just use examples of U.S. statistics, but you see in Scandinavia, in the U.K., in virtually every single first world country that where social media became big, and most countries now, this happened across the board for young kids. So this wasn't just a cultural thing, which again proved more causation to show, hey, it's not that U.S. children, something's happening that's increasing more anxiety and depression. It's happening literally everywhere. So it goes to what happened everywhere where you can, social media. So he does a good job at building up his argument, showing that. And I guess, just rambling off of what he said in the book, did anything for you to stick out of, I didn't know that before, or that's information that surprised me? Because everything I'm saying is information that I'm sure isn't shocking, but is put in a very succinct and explainable way to go, that all makes sense. Did anything shock either of you of going, that's something I didn't know? For example, that stat about men and women. I actually didn't know that one of women's friends versus boyfriends. So that stuck out. But did anything like that stick out to either of you?
I guess not like that one did, because I didn't know that.
Yeah.
but I think just it was more like everything I kind of knew a little bit glossed over it, but he like really dug in there and really makes it very clear to you. And you got to like actually see it and think about it and be like, oh man, yeah, that makes sense. You know, that's what I kept thinking through the whole thing. Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That, that jives, you know, the timing and everything, that makes sense. And yeah, when they got to the section about how it affects young girls, like that's for sure 100%. I see that at home with my daughters, and I see that at school with my female students. Mm-hmm. So he's spot on with that. I mean, you think about Facebook. I mean, even adults, like my wife is always scrolling through Facebook, and she always thinks like, these people have, that's all so perfect and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, that's all you see. You don't see their normal stuff day to day. You see the perfect snapshots, you know, and it's just, they get to go here on vacation. They have this car and they have that. And it's like, they probably have this debt and that debt that we don't have because we don't do that as much or whatever. Like, so I don't know. It's that FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. I think that's one of the biggest things that I see with kids at school, and they're not on their phone. It's like they're just so used to being in the know with, you know, what's going on with these people, what's going on with this group, what's going on social media with these influencers. And then when they don't have it, it's like you can just see, it's just, they just cannot wait to get their phones and get it. Like when we do exams, that's like the one time that kids are pretty on board. They know they can't have their phone with them during an exam or like state testing or something. So they put their stuff in the old phone hotel without any problems for that. But, you know, it's like a couple hours, and it's just funny. As soon as the class is dismissed and they can go get their phones, they just all huddle around it and they get it out right away. They're like checking everything. And it's wild. You know, that FOMO, like they just got to know as soon as they can. What'd I miss? What's going on? It's like they don't grab the phone and put it in their pocket and let's go to lunch. I'll check later. It's like, they don't even leave the room until they check up on everything, you know? So I knew a lot of this stuff, but I think he just did such a great job providing evidence and really just smacking you in the face with it, where it's like, you can't, like you said, you can't not avoid it, but you can't you can't really fight against it. Like, everything he says makes sense, you know?
So much so that I saw this more in interviews, because he went on so many, he was on news stations, he was everywhere promoting this book, and he's very much pushing and wants society to start making these changes about, hey, phone-free schools, more play outside, all of this. I want to make clear that he didn't invent this. This is not, this book did compiling and doing that, but he didn't discover this. This wasn't to, look what I found.
Phone-free schools existed before Jonathan Haidt.
Yes. He did not go, look, everybody.
He is just supporting it.
Look at this problem that nobody's pointed out yet. He is compiling. So it's more so, I look at this more as an advocating book than it is a fresh discovery of that sort. Actually, just talking on the bookend of sometimes when reading some of the chapter titles or the subheader titles, as soon as you read that, you go, ah, okay, I know exactly what this section's going to talk about, because the subheader, you know, when I said to you four, I'm going over some of them. So in the virtual world, there's disembodied, asynchronous, one-to-many, low-barrier to entry. You can go, as soon as you hear it's one-to-many communication, oh, what that means is that you can kind of fill in the gaps yourself. Yeah. So he almost, I don't want to say this could have been a memo, but this I could see being, since he's a professor, a great presentation of, hey, look at all these things that I found. And he's just putting a presentation into a book form. And I think what I'm going to start doing in the future, maybe nonfiction books, audiobook may be better, because it's just, I don't need to physically read books like this. It's much easier to.
Yeah.
Yes. But for this book in particular, there's a lot of graphs.
There's a lot of images. If you hear the narrator would have to go, right now we're showing a graph.
Yeah. That's literally what they did. I did both the audiobook, and so in the car, I'd have the audiobook, and then when I'd basically have to pick the book up, back up at whenever wherever I got, and backfill the chapter with the graphs and go, oh, that's what they were referencing.
Yeah, okay, so I it did help the that same, I
physically
read
it. Yes.
Did you do the same, Chris?
I did, yeah. I'd be driving or whatever, and then I'd be like, oh, man. Because, he'd say that. I'm like, but if you look at this graph or this, and I'm like, dang it. So, I did the same, But it is nice audio to hear him, like, talk about it. I feel like it's helpful to do both with a book like this, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly, so I can't believe we're all adults now. That's great. So all being adults, I think, obviously, we still have our own phone addictions, or we use our phone just as much. So has this book changed the way that you think you'll use your phone? But do you think that you're just as much as a victim of phone usage? And how do you kind of see, after reflecting and going, okay, these are all the bad things about social media, these are the bad things about phone addiction, etc., how much do you think we fall victim to it?
I think a lot. I know I do, for sure. I remember in the last year, I have AT&T, and they had like a nationwide like outage for like a whole day. And I remember being at work in the morning, and like, I usually just check my phone, like when I, before my first class, and then I check it at lunch, and then at the end of the day, I don't really get on it in between. But because I knew I didn't have any service all of a sudden in the morning, then it was like all day long. It just feels weird when you're that disconnected. And maybe it's because, I'm like, well, what if something's up with my wife or my other kids? And like, obviously the school phone is working, they would have called me, but it was like a sobering thing where it's like, man, we are really reliant on these little computers we keep in our pocket, you know, like, our whole life is on them. So I do think that I could probably learn to use it less. I feel like I don't use it like crazy, but that was a moment where I was like, maybe I rely on my phone too much.
That's a good point on, I believe Jonathan Haidt goes into it a little bit, but for all these things that we want to do for children, like, children need to be off social media, they need to, disconnect. That ultimately starts with the parents. It's a lot more difficult to tell the kid, no cell phone, no social media usage, when they see, you know, mom and dad still on it all the time. And so,
yes,
I, to give a fun example, like just a moment of joy in at least my extended family of last time I was at Thanksgiving, a bunch of my cousins, they have all their kids over and mm-hmm. not a single one of them has a cell phone and wow. they're all into their, I believe the oldest one was 15, but everyone doesn't have any electronic devices. Mm-hmm. And I could tell a difference. They've never used it. They don't use it at all. The littlest ones were coming up to me and I was making the macaroni and cheese and said like, yeah. can I help out? And so I was yeah. showing them how to do something. Like, but all of them were socially interactive with all of us. None of them were isolated. Like I believe at some point they did watch some TV, but yeah. they did a whole play outside where they made up a dance routine to one of Taylor Swift's songs. And so they performed oh, that man. For us, but they were all just so socially engaged and I could just tell a difference of man, these kids are being raised right. Yeah. And it was a happy moment. I noticed that none of them had phones, not one. And I don't know, it's at least anecdotal, but it was enough evidence for me of going like, yeah, that's the way to do it.
It is. I think if you can avoid it as long as possible, I think it's the way to go. I agree.
So is that do you think that's more the solution of individual parents introduce social media, introduce phones very hesitantly? However, society wide, when he gets to the end of the book here and he's saying this is what mm-hmm. this is what the law should be, this is how you should enact this. How yeah. much realism is there, and can the world actually change in any significant way, just as a community, as, let's say yeah. statewide, countrywide?
I think the easiest one that he was talking about is just for more local school boards to implement phone-free schools, of just mm-hmm. the, yeah. you know, putting yeah. putting the phone in the locked pouch, and then giving the yeah. pouch back to the kid.
Hotel.
Or the hotel. Mm-hmm. Probably not the hotel.
But doesn't seem to work good.
Doesn't seem to work really well. But the other one, just phone, and not the, because he did bring up a point of the hybrid where they're still allowed their phones in between classes, but like,
oh yeah,
it just yeah. like most addictions, like there's a withdrawal phase. And so
oh yeah,
being able to have it through the period, like different mm-hmm. break periods
yeah,
is just going to make it worse mm-hmm. versus you take it yeah. away in the beginning. It's going to yeah. suck for them for like first hour.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be fine.
And then they get used to it. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So I think yeah. that's the most reasonable one of just yeah. more parents advocating at school boards to get your local school to be yeah. phone free.
Yeah.
Certainly.
I think there is, I mean, out of parents' hands, there is that he talked about, and I mentioned a couple of times about right now there's that law that says technically a child has to be 13 or whatever to be have a social media account. But I told you how easy it is mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. them to just get one still anyway and lie. Like there, I do feel like there's a responsibility for these companies and maybe the government, the state, I don't know, somewhere to really lock down on that. But it's also a business. It's kind of like, I liked how he likened it to like, the, you know, the alcohol companies and cigarette companies and all that, you know, there's a reason that they're allowing that to happen because they want to get, kids into that as quick as possible. Cause that's going to be their future customers, you know? So it's a hard battle there for sure. But like you said, parent-wise, yeah, like delaying phone as long as possible, making sure you, even if they have a tablet, like they come with so much parental controls that you can control things with. But even that's not always going to be safe. So making sure you control screen time, make sure they're not on it too much, make sure they're, you know, when it's time for bed, it gets charged or put not by the kid, not in their room. Cause that's not a good idea. But all those things just to, and expose them to things in real life. All that kind of stuff, I think helps a lot. And I think reading this was a good eye opener for me. Cause I still have two that are younger that I got to make sure I keep doing things better with. And as your parents probably told you guys, what I always tell my kids is that, you know, I'm going to do the best I can, and I hope you guys are better parents than I am someday when you have kids, because that's all you can hope for.
Every generation is a test dummy for something. Yep. Look at past generations of smoking cigarettes. Several generations of a word that's normalized.
Lawn darts.
And lawn darts.
Yeah.
Wait, what's that?
I remember that being an experiment for people.
Oh, what is that?
You don't know lawn darts? Oh, those were, that's the great one.
Let me look up lawn darts.
You never played with lawn darts? Oh, you missed out, man. You missed out.
Oh, I know what those are. Yeah.
Yeah. The great fun game with potential grave bodily harm.
They're just darts. Yeah.
No, but they're big, and you throw them at a lawn, and if someone's there, it stabs them because it's a big metal sharp object that flies through the air.
Why does it say lawn darts ban? Oh, what happened here?
Yeah, they banned most of them.
Dang.
Because they threw sharp metal objects into the sky near people.
Wow.
You wonder how that one got across the, you know, the cutting room floor, like how they were like, this will be fine.
Yeah. It's not a knife. It has fins.
Yeah. Yeah. Slow it down. Oh, yeah.
That, looking at it, that does look kind of menacing.
Yeah.
But that's the more optimistic thing is our generation, not yours. You're the old, very old person.
Yeah,
younger generation. No, no. Since we grew up with the technology and know the effects it's had on us personally, mm-hmm. we know are better prepared for next generation. And we'll screw up something that they'll have to fix too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to screw up AI. I'm going to be so robophobic when I'm older. You will not date that goddamn robot. You will not marry that AI. No son of mine. we're going to have to deal with, I don't know how to approach AI. No idea.
Well, I mean, hey, that's a separate conversation. If you see all the different news reports of kids graduating and going through grades, never actually writing or studying anything.
It's ChatGPT.
It's just ChatGPT. And teachers are just going, I don't know what to do. I can't fail every single one of them. That's not possible. That's another conversation for you that we'll have later.
Oh, yeah. That's wild.
Society might have to go back to its roots in some ways, because Philip Chase BookTube channel, they were having a conversation on AI. He's a professor. He's just taking his students back to paper. And you can't do laptops in class. And
can't do AI on paper.
There is something about that of like, oh, anyone argues like, hey, I type faster. It's like, yes, there are advantages, but there are clear disadvantages. And you just, when you have a school policy, you can't have, like, it's a wide brush. Like, yes, you may actually work out with it. Typing may actually be better for you than physical writing, but that's not true for everyone. So,
right. Yep.
No, yeah. I'm with him on that. Like, but the thing is, that's just the general lesson of if you don't use it, you lose it. Mm, and ChatGPT and all the AI problems is just if you don't figure out how to learn how to solve a problem, if we keep outsourcing our thinking and our writing to something else, we're not going to be able to do it anymore.
You have to learn.
And that's terrifying.
The point of an essay isn't to, oh, did I do good? It's to learn how to compile a sentence and learn how to make an argument or a conclusion or put logical things together of this is the setup, this is my thesis, this is my proof. That's the point of
Just having the general curiosity of being given a question to answer and not having, like, you have to go look it up instead of literally typing in the question and getting the answer of going, oh, how would I find the answer? Well, it's a question about math, so I'm probably gonna have to go to the math section. All right, what's it about in math? It's whatever it is. Like, that process is necessary. And honestly, it's not even AI, but the internet itself. I think for our generation, we lost something when we were able to do research on the internet compared to having to go to the library. Going to the library is slower, but there's something about that. So I only had to do one paper like that where I had to go to the local university library for the law textbooks because it was harder to do it online. Mm-hmm. That was so great for me. It was so hard. It was one of the hardest essays I had to do, but
yeah,
it's great.
We lost something when we didn't have to forage our own food. We got to go back to, we don't even know how to hunt and gather anymore.
I know.
What have we become? What the hell? Yeah, it's very hard to juggle. What should you actually spend your time? What should you be more efficient with and let technology take control of? And what should you actually know, though this is something you need to do and learn yourself? Because obviously, not all of us needs to go have a farm and grow carrots. Well, I'll go buy carrots at grocery store. I don't need to learn and grow carrots in my backyard. That's a good thing to delegate. Delegate how you critically think. That's something that you should probably be more in control of to be a better person. But yeah, Chris, next time AI talk, we got to find a book that talks about AI's effect on the next generation. Gen Alpha. That's what they're calling. Gen Alpha is, I think, 20.
Gen Alpha.
I think it's 2013 and onward. Let me see. Gen Alpha age range. 2010 to 2024 is Gen Alpha.
Okay. So that's, my two younger ones are Alpha. Okay.
So you have two Gen Z, two Gen Alpha. Wow.
Yeah. I do. Well,
Chris, do you have anything finally we'd like to say about Jonathan Hyatt, this book, something you want to pass along to the people that, like, the biggest takeaway?
Highly recommend the book. Definitely should read it, whether you are a parent. I think it can speak to you. If you're a teacher, it can speak to you. Or if you're like Richard and Austin and you grew up in this, I think it can speak to you as well. And it's just the biggest thing I think takeaway from this is just in life, whether you're a parent trying to parent your kids or anything you do, always be learning, always be growing, and always be willing to change and adapt to be the best person you can be for yourself, but also for others, especially those looking up to you and the ones that you influence, for example, as a parent or a teacher. So I think that's the biggest takeaway is that this world can be messed up and we have to be willing to do what's best to make it better than how we found it.
Triple B, Bearded Book Beast. Check them out. Link in the description below. Thanks, Chris, for coming on.
Yeah, dude. Thank you, guys. This was a blast.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
See you.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week. Save big.